my dad makes me lunch every day. I've been throwing it in the garbage on the way to school. He's pretty mad. That was hard to imagine. Anyway, my mother found this rose on our doormat when she got home from work. It's like this really perfect-looking rose. Weird, huh? I let her talk about it a little more, about who might have left it and why. I knew she wanted me to say that Colin probably did it, but I just couldn't make myself say the words. The third note. The next morning was the first really cold day of December. "You need the jacket with the hood," Mom rasped from her bed. Her voice never sounded normal until after coffee. "Look in the front closet." She seemed to think that it was really helpful to lie in bed, listening to the radio and calling out weather reports. I couldn't help thinking about how, in my book, Meg's mother had French toast waiting for Meg in the morning. She was a single mom, too, with Meg's dad being held prisoner halfway across the universe. I found the coat, still streaked with gray from last year's dirty snow, and put it on. A little stiff, but it seemed to fit okay. "Where are my gloves?" I called.
"No idea, sorry."
"Can I take some money?"
"Coat pocket."
I felt around in her coat and found a $5 bill and three singles in one pocket, and her striped scarf rolled up in the other. I grabbed the singles and the scarf. "Bye." The laughing man was still asleep with his head under the mailbox. He had found some cardboard to put underneath him.
Still, he must have been freezing.
Some mornings I'd seen kids banging on the mailbox and yelling, "Wake up, kicker!" I hoped no one would do that today. I watched my breath billowing out in front of me and race-walked toward school. The sun was out but had no warmth yet. I shoved my hands in my pockets and felt a bunch of old tissues. Yuck. And the $3. And something else. A little piece of paper folded in half. I pulled it out. I recognized your tiny handwriting right away, all wobbly with those weird loops you put on top of your T's and L's. "You will want proof. 3 p.m. today, Colin's knapsack. Christmas Day, Tesser Well. April 27th, Studio TV 15. P.S. Yawns do serve a purpose. They cool the brain by bringing air high into the nasal passage, which has the effect of increasing alertness." The note was on the same dried-up paper as the first two. 3 p.m. today, Colin's knapsack. I had absolutely no idea what that could mean, or how you knew Colin. Christmas Day. Tesser Well. This one had something to do with my book. To Tesser meant to travel through space or time or both. It was how Meg got to Kamazots, the planet where her father was held prisoner. But it had nothing to do with Christmas, as far as I knew. April 27th, Studio TV 15. April 27th was Richard's birthday, but of course back in December I had never heard of Studio TV 15. Since Mom didn't get her postcard from the $20,000 pyramid until a couple of weeks ago. I think it was the P.S. that freaked me out most. I thought of the day Sal got punched, when I had carried my Mysteries of Science poster home. I read the note over and over, till my hands were frozen and I was forced to put them back in my pockets. It made no sense. The only thing it really helped me understand was that you were watching me. And I had no idea who you were, or what you wanted. I was almost to the garage when Marcus came out of his door right in front of me. He had on his regular green army jacket, but he was wearing gloves and had a hat pulled down over his ears. I expected him to ignore me like he always did, but instead he waved and started walking along next to me. Things that make no sense. Marcus and I got to Broadway without saying anything. I was thinking. "I thought of a question for you," I said finally.
"Okay."
"Let's say I build a time machine." I waited to see if he would laugh at this, but he just nodded and looked thoughtful. "And let's say I decide I want to go back to last Wednesday.
Let's say I want to go to the movies while the other me is still in school.
Okay.
I exhaled a big white cloud.
I won't get to last Wednesday until after I leave, right? I mean, I won't know if I'm really going to get there until I actually get there.
Right. In your experience, you won't know if you're going to get there until after you leave.
I mean, unless you remember seeing yourself on the street or something.
Or we could ask the ticket guy at the theater.
He was serious.
What?
At the movie theater. Which one are you planning to go to?
Because we could ask the ticket guy if you were there.
Then we'll know whether or not you're going to get there.
But I haven't left yet. I haven't even built the time machine.
So?
It doesn't matter when you leave. It's just whether or not you get there that matters.
Wait, I take that back. It does matter when you leave. Because if you don't leave for 50 years, even if you were there, the ticket guy probably won't recognize you.
What are you talking about?
Well, let's say you finish your time machine in 50 years. You'd be...
62, I said. We were across the street from school, waiting for the green light. I could see kids coming from every direction, all bundled up in hats and scarves.
Okay, so let's say you're 62, and you climb into your machine and go back to last Wednesday, December whatever, 1978. You go to the movie theater. The ticket guy would see a 62-year-old woman, right?
Right, I said. So far, everything made sense.
So if we went over to the theater today and asked him whether he saw you there last Wednesday, he'd say no, because his common sense would tell him that you can't be that 62-year-old woman, and she can't be you. Get it?
I shook my head. If we asked today, he couldn't have seen me anyway. I wouldn't have been there yet, because I haven't gone back yet.
Duh, said a voice behind us.
It's really not all that complicated.
I whirled around and saw Julia in a long coat. She was standing right behind us waiting for the light.
Marcus ignored her and looked at me.
Are you still worrying about that book? About the kids and seeing themselves land in the broccoli?
I said nothing. I wasn't going to have Julia hear any more of this conversation.
Think of it like this, Marcus said, oblivious to the look she was giving us. Time isn't a line stretching out in front of us, going in one direction. It's, well, time is just a construct, actually.
Look, Julia said, cutting him off. If you really need to know what he means, I'll explain it to you.
This should be good, I thought. Julia is going to explain the nature of time.
I turned around and looked at her.
Fine, go ahead.
She pulled off one of her gloves. They were these beautiful, fuzzy, pale yellow gloves, and she yanked a ring from her finger.
I think of it like this, she said, holding up the ring. It was gold, studded all the way around with...
Are those diamonds? I said.
Diamond chips, she shrugged.
Look, it's like every moment in time is a diamond sitting on this ring. Pretend the ring is really big with diamonds all around, and each diamond is one moment. Got it?
Marcus was silent, just looking at her.
I laughed. Time is a diamond ring, I said. That explains everything. Thanks.
Would you shut up and listen? If you figured out a way to bring yourself to another time, probably through some sort of teleportation, you'd be somehow recreating your atoms, really. Not physically moving them, I'm guessing. That would be tricky.
Can we not worry about that part right now? I said.
I'm freezing. We were still standing across the street from school, even though the light had changed once already, and then gone back to red.
Okay, put it this way. We're kind of jumping from diamond to diamond. Like in cartoons where someone is running on a barrel, trying to stay on top. We have to keep moving. There's no choice.
Now we're in a cartoon on a barrel?
She sighed and shook her head.
Okay, forget that. Let's stick with the ring.
She held it up again.
Let's say we're here.
She put her fingernail on one diamond chip. And we figure out a way to jump all the way back to here. She pointed to another one a few chips away. It wouldn't matter where we came from. If we're on that chip, we're at that moment. It doesn't matter whether we came from the chip behind it or 10 chips ahead of it. If we're there, we're there. Get it? No, I don't get it. Because what you're saying makes absolutely no...
I do, Marcus said quietly. I get it. I know what she means.
Thank you, Julia said. I'm glad someone here has a brain. And she stomped off through the red light while Marcus stared after her. I turned to him. So you're saying this diamond chip is just sitting there minding its own business, and then suddenly a bunch of kids land in the diamond chip's broccoli patch. Marcus's face lit up. Stop! I see your problem. You're thinking that time exists on the diamonds themselves. It doesn't. Each moment, each diamond is like a snapshot. A snapshot of what? Of everything, everywhere. There's no time in a picture, right? It's the jumping from one diamond to the next that we call time. But like I said, time doesn't really exist. Like that girl just said, a diamond is a moment, and all the diamonds on the ring are happening at the same time. It's like having a drawer full of pictures. On the ring, I said. Yes. All the diamonds exist at once. He looked triumphant. So if you jump backward, you are at that moment. You are in that picture. And you always were there. You always will be there, even if you don't know it yet. I didn't understand a word of it, and I couldn't feel my feet. Forget it, I said. The whole thing is making me crazy. He nodded like he felt sorry for me and my stupid brain. I think that's probably because of your common sense. You can't accept the idea of arriving before you leave. The idea that every moment is happening at the same time. That it's us who are moving. Enough was enough. I cut him off. Why did you hit Sal? I asked. Who? He looked completely mystified, as if I had just changed the subject from something very normal to something completely insane, instead of the other way around. My friend Sal. You punched him in the stomach for no reason, in front of the garage, and then you hit him in the face. He nodded. Yes, he said. That's right. But no, there was a reason. That's bull. I know he never did a thing to you. I started to really shiver, even with my hands stuffed in my pockets and Mom's scarf wrapped around my head. I did hit him for a reason, he said. What you're talking about is a justification. I'm not saying it was the right thing to do. I'm just saying I did it for a reason, my own stupid reason. I stared at him. So what was the reason? He looked down and shrugged. Same reason I do most things. I wanted to see what would happen. What do you mean, what would happen? His nose started bleeding, that's what happened, and he almost threw up. Besides that, besides the ordinary things, he tapped the toe of one shoe on the sidewalk. It was dumb, really, really dumb. And? And what? And did anything happen, besides the ordinary things? He shook his head. No, not that I could tell. I was going to tell him that he was wrong, that other things had happened, like Sal closing the door in my face that afternoon and never opening it again. But at that moment, I noticed the laughing man coming down the block behind us. I'd never seen him near school before. He was bent forward, mumbling and watching his feet, with his eyes on the garbage can right next to Marcus. The laughing man didn't notice us standing there until he was practically on top of Marcus. When he finally looked up, he cursed, twisted away, and took off in the other direction, sprinting like he was running a race. We watched him rush all the way back to Broadway and disappear around the corner. That was weird, I said. Yeah, Marcus agreed, And it's the second time it's happened.
The first proof.
You know, what did I tell you? Jimmy said at lunch that same day, happily slapping the counter with both hands. They never think you'll actually count the bread. Never in a million years would they think you'd count. The bread order had come up 2 rolls short. I counted it twice to make sure. Jimmy swaggered over to the phone with a huge smile on his face.
You just made his day, Colin whispered. Maybe his whole week.
He was folding slices of ham and laying them out neatly on little squares of waxed paper. I watched Colin's fingers as they picked up each piece of ham. He didn't just smack them in half like I saw Jimmy do. Colin sort of bent each slice into a pretty fan shape. Once I started watching, I couldn't stop. It was hypnotizing somehow. I talked to Anne-Marie last night, I said. I think she's coming back to school tomorrow. Colin nodded. Good. It was hard to imagine him sneaking around and leaving a rose on anyone's doormat. But I guess boys will surprise you sometimes. Hey, he said suddenly. You know what? I'm sick of cheese and lettuce sandwiches. He glanced guiltily at Jimmy, who was still on the phone talking about his missing rolls. Want to go get a slice of pizza? We acted like everything was normal, making our sandwiches and wrapping them up like we planned to eat them at school. And then we ran to the pizza place down the block. It was crazy, but we felt like we were doing something wrong. We rushed back to school, stuffing pizza into our mouths and crouching down low when we passed Jimmy's window so he couldn't see us. Somehow we became so completely hysterical that we were still having what Mom calls fits of helpless laughter when we got to school. We must have sort of burst into the classroom, because everybody looked up from their silent reading to stare at us. Julia rolled her eyes. You're late again, Mr. Tompkins said. And then the whole feeling dissolved and we went to find our books. I sat with my book open on my desk, thinking about the note in my coat pocket. 3 p.m. today, Colin's knapsack, your first proof. I had to get a look inside Colin's bag to find whatever would or wouldn't be waiting for me. At 3 on the dot, I went to the coat closet and grabbed my knapsack to go home. Colin's was just a few hooks away. I could hear him talking to Jay Stringer in the back of the room near Main Street. Julia was standing with them, trying again to convince Jay about her stupid tinfoil UFO and how it was going to fly up and down the street on a stupid invisible wire. She still hadn't gotten her project approved. I reached over and unzipped Colin's bag. There was his denim-covered binder stuffed with falling-out papers, a paperback, and the cheese sandwich he hadn't eaten at lunch, soaking through its paper and smelling like pickles. Nothing unusual. I felt around the bottom of the bag and touched some keys on a ring, resting in a pile of dirt or maybe crushed leaves. I tipped the bag toward the light and saw that it wasn't a pile of dirt. It was a pile of crumbs. Breadcrumbs. I patted the back of the bag, felt a lump, reached behind his binder, and pulled out 2 of Jimmy's rolls. They were flaking all over the place. Colin must have grabbed them straight out of the delivery bag when nobody was looking. Things You Give Away. I dropped the rolls back into Colin's bag, pulled my coat on, threw my knapsack over one shoulder, and took the stairs 2 at a time. There was a mob of kids outside like always, pushing and laughing and standing around talking, even though it was still freezing and had started to rain. I took a minute to look for Sal, like I always do. No sign of him. I wound Mom's scarf around my ears, turned north and started walking up the hill to Anne-Marie's. It didn't make sense. Not that Colin had taken the rolls. In fact, that was just the kind of thing I expected from Colin. But my brain was yelling all kinds of other questions at me. How could anyone possibly have known that Colin would take the rolls? And when had the note been put in my coat pocket? It didn't occur to me that you could have left it there the same day you put the first note in my library book about the Squirrel Village. I didn't get that at all, until much later. And why me? I jumped a gutter full of rainwater and took the last steps to Anne-Marie's building. Why was I the one getting the notes? Why did I have to do something about whatever bad thing was going to happen? I didn't even understand what I was supposed to do. Write a letter about something that hadn't happened yet? Miranda, my brain said, nothing is going to happen. Someone is playing with you. But what if my brain was wrong? What if someone's life really needed saving? What if it wasn't a game? Anne-Marie's doorman waved me in. Upstairs, her father answered the door with an unlit cigar in his mouth and asked me whether I wanted some cold noodles with sesame sauce. No thanks.
Fizzy lemonade, then.
He helped me tug my wet coat off. The lining was all stuck to my sweater. So I walked into Anne-Marie's room, balancing my lemonade and an ice water for her, along with a dish of almonds that her father had somehow warmed up. Warm almonds sounds kind of yuck, but in reality they taste pretty good. Anne-Marie was still in her nightgown, but she looked normal. My dad won't stop feeding me, she said, taking a handful of nuts, and he won't let me get dressed. He says pajamas are good for the soul. Isn't that so dumb? I sat on the edge of her bed. Is that the rose? It was on her bedside table in a tiny silver vase. Just the kind of thing they would have at Anne-Marie's house. She nodded and looked at it. The rose was perfect, just opening, like a picture in a magazine. I tried to draw it, Anne-Marie said. She held out a little spiral pad of heavy white paper. She'd sketched the rose in dark pencil over and over. Wow, I said. I didn't know you could draw like that. She flipped the pad closed. My dad shows me tricks sometimes. There are a lot of tricks to drawing. I can show you. But I knew I could never draw like that. For the same reason I couldn't do Jimmy's V-cut or get my Main Street diagrams to look good. Hey, I said, maybe your dad left you the rose. Maybe. She frowned, and I felt a little piece of myself light up. He says he didn't, though. But it would explain how the person got upstairs, why the doorman didn't buzz you. I could feel my lips making a smile. Your dad is so nice. It has to be him. I was miserable, sitting on the edge of her bed in that puddle of meanness. But I couldn't help it. I didn't want Anne-Marie's rose to be from Colin. Maybe I couldn't stand for her to have so many people, and to be able to draw and cut bread on top of that. Maybe I want to call in for myself. Anne-Marie's dad stuck his head through the doorway.
Anybody need a refill?
No thanks, I said, even though my glass was empty and my back teeth were packed with chewed nuts. I have to go.
Stay for 5 more minutes, he said. I put your coat in the dryer.
So I had to sit there, thirsty. And then I had to put on my dry, warm, but still dirty coat and take the elevator down to Anne-Marie's lobby, where the lamps glowed yellow and the doorman remembered my name. It had stopped raining. It was too cold for the boys to hang around in front of the garage. There was hardly anyone out on the street at all. The light in Belle's window looked friendly in the late afternoon gloom, and I thought of going in. I had been telling Belle the story of my book, a little bit here and a little bit there. I told her how Meg helped her father escape, and I described the first battle with it, which is this giant, evil brain that wants to control everyone. I knew Belle would give me some vitamin C's and maybe a paper cup of hot chocolate, but it was getting late and I didn't want to have to walk down our block in the complete dark, so I decided to keep going. At first, I thought the laughing man wasn't on the corner. But then I saw him sitting on the wet curb, leaning against the mailbox and just watching me walk toward him. For 1 second, there was something familiar about him, and I noticed for the first time how old he looked. I thought about what Louisa had said, about how old people can't get enough heat.
Maybe I felt sorry for him. Maybe he reminded me of Mr. Nunzi from upstairs. Or maybe I wanted to do something good, to make up for being kind of a jerk to Anne Marie, even if she didn't really know it. Anyway, I spoke to him. "Hey," I said, opening my bag. "You want a sandwich?" I still had the cheese sandwich I hadn't eaten at lunch. I held it out. "It's cheese and tomato."
"Is it on a hard roll?"
He sounded tired.
"I can't eat hard bread. Bad teeth."
"It isn't hard," I said. It was one of my best V-cuts ever. Probably a little soggy now with the juice from the tomatoes soaking into the bread all afternoon. He reached up with one hand, and I put the sandwich in it.
"What was the burn scale today?"
he asked. "I'm not sure," I said, pretending I knew what he was talking about. "I didn't have a chance to, check."
"Rain is no protection," he said, looking at the sandwich in his hand. "They should have had the dome up."
"Maybe tomorrow," I said. He looked up at me, and suddenly he seemed familiar again. It was something about the way his eyes took me in. He said,
"I'm an old man, and she's gone now. So don't worry, okay?"
I won't. He nodded.
Smart kid.
Things that get stuck. Guess what? I said to Mom when she got home. The Laughing Man isn't completely crazy. He's kind of a CSP.
CSP?
Crazy-shaped person.
Don't say crazy-shaped person. And what are you talking about?
I gave him a sandwich today. He was sort of normal about it, almost.
You gave him a sandwich?
It was a leftover from Jimmy's.
Mira, why in the world would you give the Laughing Man a sandwich?
What's wrong with that? I thought you would like it.
You thought I would like the fact that you struck up a relationship with a mentally ill person?
What relationship? I just gave him a sandwich.
We've talked about this, Miranda. I thought you knew how to handle yourself. It's the only reason I let you walk around alone.
I just gave a sandwich to a homeless guy. You're the one who works for criminals and hangs around with pregnant jailbirds.
Not everyone accused of a crime is a criminal, you know. And besides, I'm not 12.
I pointed at her sweatshirt, which had a rainbow on it.
Well, you dress like you're 12.
I could feel the tears starting, so I grabbed two bags of the chips Louisa had brought over, went to my room, and slammed the door. A few minutes later, she knocked and came in.
I'm sorry. You did a nice thing. I shouldn't have blown up at you like that.
Why did you then? She sat down on the bed next to me.
I don't know. I guess it made me nuts thinking you were putting yourself in danger. I like to tell myself that you're always safe, but there's no such thing, really, is there? I do trust you, Mira. I want you to know that. I don't want to make any more mistakes. I don't think I can bear to make one more single mistake.
What are you talking about? What mistakes? She laughed.
Are you kidding? Where should I start? I've made about a million mistakes. Luckily, you outweigh almost all of them.
Almost all of them? Like how many?
She smiled. I don't know. 999,000.
So that just leaves, what, 1,000 to go?
Richard wants to move in, she said flatly. He wants us to get married.
And my brain said, he does? Then I got this feeling of lightness. I was happy. That's great, I told Mom.
You think so?
She smiled for a second, and then her mouth dropped.
I don't know. I just can't, I can't figure out if it's the right thing.
Don't you love him?
Of course I do. I don't know if it's the right thing for you, I mean.
Is that why you won't give him a key? Because of me? She shook her head slowly.
I don't know.
I just feel stuck. Like I'm afraid to take any steps in case they're the wrong ones. I need a little more time to think.
She stood up.
The water's probably boiling by now. Spaghetti in 10 minutes.
Spaghetti again. We were kind of stuck, I realized. In a lot of ways.
Tied up things.
You two have certainly gotten close, Mom said the following weekend while she helped me tug the rollaway cot from the overstuffed hall closet. That's nice, right?
Anne-Marie was sleeping over for the first time.
Don't you ever vacuum? I said. There's dust bunnies behind all the doors.
Give me a break, Mira, she said sharply.
I mean it. I saw a roach in the bathroom this morning. This place looks gross.
Mom glared at me. A whole angry conversation seemed to pass over her face. Then she said,
You know what? Do this yourself, and walked away.
I pulled the cot into my room and lined it up next to my bed the way Sal and I always had. Then I wondered whether that was the way other girls did it.
Was the cot supposed to be against the far wall? Should I make an L shape with my bed so that just our heads were together?
I decided on the L shape, stood back, adjusted the angle, and then went to get the sheets out of the bathroom closet. Starting when we were really little, Sal and I used to beg to have sleepovers on the weekends, and lots of nights I fell asleep happy with Sal next to me on the rollaway. But he was never there in the morning. I would wake up and see the empty cot with its tumbled-up striped sheets, and Mom would tell me what had happened. He'd woken up with a stomachache, or a headache, or a bad dream, and wanted to go home. She'd hand me a tissue and say,
I don't know why we keep doing this. Sal cries in the middle of the night, and then you cry in the morning.
A couple of weeks later, we would try again, and I always believed that this would be the time Sal would still be there in the morning. Eventually, we stopped trying, and then those striped blue sheets made me sad to look at. But they were the only ones we had that fit the cot. I tucked them in and went to Mom's room to take one of her pillows. She was still being angry in the living room. I fluffed the pillow, placed it carefully on the cot, and stood back. It looked okay. I was still standing there when the buzzer rang, and I got this clear mental picture of Anne-Marie and her dad in our lobby with the cigarette smell and the ugly ceiling light full of dead bugs. It was like a vision, almost.
I went to the intercom and pushed the talk button.
Who is it?
Her dad's voice.
It's Anne-Marie and her unshaven father.
I buzzed long and hard in a way that was supposed to say, You are extra welcome to be here. Also, the lobby door is so heavy I wanted to give them time to get it open.
Mom came and stood next to me by the front door,
saying nothing and running her fingers through her hair.
She was wearing jeans and had changed her t-shirt for a black turtleneck sweater.
It was at that moment, standing next to her, that I figured out the truth. The truth was that Mom saw it too. The peeling paint, the cigarette butts on the stairs, everything.
It soaked into me like water into sand, fast and heavy-making.
But I still couldn't apologize for what I'd said. I wanted to, but I couldn't. I couldn't even smile at her.
Welcome, Mom sang to Anne-Marie's dad. I'm so glad Anne-Marie can spend the night with us.
Anne-Marie's dad had a cardboard box full of stuff, little containers and plastic bags, which he offered to Mom.
I'm sure Miranda's mentioned that Anne-Marie eats a special diet, he started.
Oh, Mom looked at me. Actually, never fear. He pushed the box at her again. I've brought all sorts of appropriate goodies.
Feel free to sample them yourself. They're not bad, if I do say so myself.
Mom smiled and took the box.
That's wonderful. Thanks. Had I known...
Never fear, Anne-Marie's dad said again.
I saw that the things inside were tied up with purple and green curly ribbon, like Christmas presents.
Anne-Marie and I played some records in my room, and Mom brought in a special platter with Anne-Marie's snacks on it, and a bowl of chips for me. And then we watched TV in the living room for a while before bed. We were watching Love Boat when we heard something hit the kitchen floor, followed by a bunch of cursing from Mom. A minute later, she popped her head in and looked at Anne-Marie. Sorry, you didn't hear that, okay? I dropped some frozen grape juice on my foot. Anne-Marie smiled a wide smile. No problem. Your mom is so cool, she said later when we were in our beds and her face was resting on Mom's pillow. I like her a lot. She's like a real person, you know? And she treats you like a real person, too. My dad still acts like I'm a baby. I guess. But who wants to be treated like a real person, I thought. I wanted to be treated like Anne-Marie and have all my snacks tied up with ribbon. When I opened my eyes in the morning, Anne-Marie was still there. I felt this big rush of relief, like I'd been worrying all night that she would disappear. Maybe I had been, without realizing it. Thank God you're awake, she said, her head propped up on one arm. I've been poking you for 20 minutes. You sleep like the dead. What time is it? I asked, throwing off my blanket. Time to eat, she said. I'm starved. Can you eat cereal? I asked. All I know how to make is cereal and toast. Nope, she said. Can't eat either one. Got any eggs? We went to the kitchen to check. Good morning. Mom was standing in front of the stove making bacon. Anne-Marie, I called your dad last night, and he told me that you have a thing for bacon omelets. Yum, Anne-Marie said. That smells great. No wonder I'm so hungry. I was staring. Mom had serious bedhead, and her eyes were puffy with sleep. But she was up at 7:30 in the morning, making us bacon omelets. I wanted to hug her, but didn't. Things That Turn Pink. It snowed a little on the second-to-last day before Christmas vacation. Snow always puts me in a good mood. Mr. Tompkin let us skip the math workbooks and spend the whole morning on our Main Street projects. Anne-Marie helped me start my swings. So far, the perfect day. By the time we walked to Jimmy's, the snow had stopped and the sidewalk was just slushy enough to make my sneakers uncomfortably wet. Mom had slept through the weather report, so I was the only one without boots. Colin started to push open Jimmy's door, but Jimmy jumped out from behind the counter and leaned against the door so it slammed in our faces. Hey! Colin smiled, thinking it was a joke, and shoved back. But I could see Jimmy's face better than Colin could. It wasn't a joke. Get out! Jimmy called through the glass. Don't come back here anymore! You're lucky I don't call the police. Anne-Marie put her hand on Colin's shoulder. I think he's serious. What? Colin saw our faces and then looked up at Jimmy through the door. What's going on? He yelled. Jimmy had one foot up against the bottom of the door. He glared at us. Some people on the street looked over, but nobody stopped. Somebody stole my bank, he said finally, his voice sounding far away. One of you. Of course we told him, through the door, that we didn't, that we wouldn't, but there was no way he was letting us in. We went to the pizza place and talked about who could have taken Jimmy's $2 bills. He ran the place alone, aside from the 40 minutes a day that we were there. Maybe someone had run in while he was in the bathroom, we thought. He usually put his back in 5 minutes sign in the window and locked the door, but not every time. Sometimes he just ran into the back for a minute, and if someone came in, they waited. Someone could have taken the bank then. But who in the world would have known to take it in the first place? It was a faded plastic bank in the shape of a cartoon character. It didn't look remotely valuable. Let's write him a letter, Anne-Marie said. Or no. We'll get him a card. She used her spoon to scrape up the last of her lunch, which her dad packed for her every day in a cleaned-out yogurt container. Come on, she said, standing up. It'll be my treat. So we went into Gold Stationery and bought Jimmy a greeting card.
I wanted to get one that said, "With sympathy for Jimmy's lost bank." But Anne-Marie said we should pick something that was blank inside. She picked a card with roses on it, which I thought was kind of strange, considering it was for Jimmy, and roses are supposed to symbolize love. She said the card looked sincere, but I guessed that she liked it because it reminded her of her mystery rose. "What do you think?" she asked Colin. She held up the card in front of him. Colin raised his shoulders and dropped them. "I guess." Anne-Marie said nothing, but she looked like she'd been hoping for a more revealing answer. "Can you put this on my dad's account?" she asked the cashier.
"Sure thing, Anne-Marie. Hey, where's your pal Julia? Homesick today?"
Anne-Marie turned pink.
"No, she's around."
The cashier smiled and handed Anne-Marie a spiral notebook with a beaten-up cover. Anne-Marie flipped it open and wrote her name and the date. A charge account at Gold's. I thought of the fat, smelly markers that cost $2.50 each, the leather diaries that locked with little keys, the battery-operated fans that you could wear on a string around your neck on hot days.
"Hey, Anne-Marie," Colin said. "Want to buy me a pack of baseball cards?"
She turned pink again.
"I can't. I mean, I'm not allowed. Sorry."
He shrugged and smiled.
"No big deal." Sometimes I wanted to squeeze Colin's cheeks until his teeth fell out.
After school, Anne-Marie and I went to her house. Her dad brought us some weird kind of thin ham rolled up so we could eat it with our fingers. We wrote on Jimmy's card, "Dear Jimmy, we did not take your Fred Flintstone bank. We don't know who could have taken it. Maybe someone came in when you went to the bathroom. Can we come back to work? Signed, your employees, Anne-Marie, Miranda, and Colin." I put the card in my knapsack so that I could slip it under Jimmy's door the next morning on my way to school. Then we lay on Anne-Marie's rug and planned all the stuff we were going to do over Christmas vacation. Anne-Marie wanted to start teaching me how to draw, even though I told her I was probably hopeless. And we were going to go to the movies, and her dad even said he would take us ice skating in Central Park. I tried not to wonder what Sal would be doing. I figured he'd be playing basketball right up until the first big snow. Things That Fall Apart. The next morning on my way to school, I pushed our card under Jimmy's locked door. At lunchtime, Colin, Anne-Marie, and I walked up to Broadway together. Jimmy was helping a customer, but he saw us through the glass door, made a face, and shook his head no. "I guess he means it," Colin said. We stood there in front of the door for a minute, just in case. When the customer left with the sandwich, Jimmy glanced over at us again. Colin put his hands together under his chin like he was praying and made a puppy dog face, which was a dumb joke, but also pretty cute. Jimmy took a rag and started wiping down the counter, and then he raised one arm and waved us in without looking up. "So we can come back to work?" Colin asked when we'd all crowded in the door. Jimmy looked at us. "You're good kids," he said. "But you don't know what you're doing half the time." "We didn't take the bank," I started, and he waved at me to be quiet.
"I know. I've been thinking about it. You can come back to work."
"Yay!"
Anne-Marie started clapping. Colin ran around slapping everyone five, including Jimmy, who even smiled.
"But here's the thing," Jimmy said after Colin had taken a victory lap behind the counter and through the back room.
"Your friend, little Swiss Miss, don't let me find her in here again, ever."
"Who?"
Anne-Marie said.
"I think he means Julia," I said.
"You think Julia took the money?"
Colin laughed.
"Julia needs money like a fish needs a bicycle."
Jimmy shook his head. "Some things are in the blood. All the money in the world can't change a person's blood."
"What do you mean, blood?"
Anne-Marie had her hands on her hips.
"What blood?"
Jimmy pointed his big finger right at me.
"Like you call her, Swiss Miss, hot chocolate."
Huh?
Colin looked at me and back to Jimmy. I was just getting it. Anne-Marie was way ahead of me.
You pig, she said. You racist pig.
I had never seen Anne-Marie angry. She was scary and also obviously about to cry. Jimmy shrugged.
It's your life. I'm not having that little thief back in here. You don't have to come back either.
I won't,
Anne-Marie shouted, and she banged out the door.
And that's not why I call her Swiss Miss, I said.
Jimmy shrugged again, and I banged out after Anne-Marie.
Colin followed me.
We found her crying halfway down the block, walking fast. She was spitting words.
That big, fat jerk! That pig! I hate him!
Colin looked at me.
I don't even get what just happened.
Anne-Marie whirled around to face us.
He thinks Julia did it because she's black. No way, Colin said. He's crazy.
Anne-Marie turned on me then.
Is that your name for her? Swiss Miss? No. I said it one time, but I didn't mean... I meant about how she's always talking about Switzerland. Her watch and the chocolate and...
She is? Colin asked. I never heard her talk about Switzerland.
If anyone needs the money, Anne-Marie said to me coldly, it's you, not Julia. Are you serious? I didn't take the stupid money. Forget it, she said. I want to be alone.
And she stomped off toward school. Colin raised his eyebrows after her and then showed me a rolled-up dollar. Want to get a slice? So we went to the pizza place, but it wasn't fun. And walking back to school, it occurred to me that Colin might not like me at all. He might just like pizza.
Tell me something, I said just before we got to our classroom. That day the bread count was short by 2 rolls. Did you take them?
Yeah, Colin said, starting to smile.
I thought it would be... Hey, I didn't steal Jimmy's bank, you know.
He looked at me through his bangs with his injured puppy face.
I know, I said quickly. I know you wouldn't. The rolls were just for fun, he said.
But taking the bank would be, you know, stealing.
Yeah.
I didn't get to talk to Anne-Marie all the rest of that afternoon. After silent reading period, she went to art and music, and I went to gym and science. And then some of the kindergartners came to our classroom to sing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And then it was Christmas vacation.
Christmas vacation.
For 3 days in a row, the sky was like a dingy white sheet. I thought about calling Anne-Marie, but didn't. I thought about calling Colin, but didn't. I was right about Sal. He was playing basketball every day. And a couple of times there were the voices of other boys, kids from school. On the third day, I opened our living room window very quietly and watched them running up and down the alley in their knit hats, with steam blowing out of their mouths. Then I sat on the couch and closed my eyes. I pictured the world. I pictured the world millions of years ago, with crazy clouds of gas everywhere, and volcanoes, and the continents bumping into each other and then drifting apart. Okay, now life begins. It starts in the water, with tiny things, microscopic, and then some get bigger. And one day something crawls out of the water onto land. There are animals, then humans, looking almost all alike. There are tiny differences in color, the shape of the face, the tone of the skin, but basically they are the same. They create shelters, grow food, experiment. They talk. They write things down. Now, fast forward. The Earth is still making loops around the sun. There are humans all over the place, driving in cars and flying in airplanes. And then one day, one human tells another human that he doesn't want to walk to school with her anymore. Does it really matter? I asked myself. It did. I tried again. I pictured the world, all pretty blue-green and floating out in space, creatures and forests and deserts and cities.
I brought North America into focus, the United States, the East Coast, New York City. Kids are walking down the street towards school. One kid has green suede boots. One has a charge account at Gold's. One has keys in her pocket.
Does it really matter? I asked myself. It did.
I got up, turned on the television, and tried to think about nothing for a change. The second proof. Mom didn't have to work on Christmas Eve day. We got a tree and strung popcorn for it, and she had some friends from work over. Richard made some eggnog from a German recipe his grandmother gave him, and they all ended up singing a lot while I wrapped presents in my room. I had bought Mom a pair of earrings, a bottle of purple nail polish with glitter in it, and some striped tights. Even though I thought, and I still think, that striped tights look dumb. I got Richard an erasable pen from Gold's. On Christmas morning, we opened presents first thing after Mom made coffee, like always. I got some good stuff. A beaded bracelet, a portable radio, a fancy journal to write in with clouds on the cover, a sweater, and a tin of these really crispy ginger cookies I love from a bakery near Mom and Richard's office. We were just about to move on to pancakes when Richard handed me a hard, rectangular package that had to be a book. Let me guess, I said, a book. I wondered if it would be the kind with the spunky girl on the cover. Very funny. Open it.
It was a book. Actually, it was my book. But this was a hardcover one, with a different picture on the front. I read the title out loud. A Wrinkle in Time. And then I smiled at Richard.
It's a first edition, Richard said.
Richard, Mom burst out. You shouldn't have.
This made me guess that first editions are expensive. Read what's inside, he said. I had the author sign it for you.
I opened the front cover. The writing was big and swoopy, beautiful.
Nothing like yours.
Miranda, Tesser Well, Madeline L'Engle. Christmas Day, Tesser Well, your second proof. It wasn't a game, I realized. Holding that book in my hands, I finally believed that whoever wrote me those notes actually knew about things before they happened. Somehow.
As soon as Richard and Mom went to make the pancakes, I ran to my room and took all your notes out of the box under my bed.
I am coming to save your friend's life, and my own.
Coming from where? I asked myself. Coming from when?
I was beginning to believe that someone I cared about was in real danger, but I still didn't know who it was, and I still didn't know how to help. I looked at the second note. I know you have shared my first note. I ask you not to share the others. Please, I do not ask this for myself. That was the worst part. I was alone.
Things in an Elevator. New Year's Day was weirdly warm and sunny. Sal's basketball was going strong by about 9 in the morning. I sneaked a look down into the alley and saw him running back and forth in just a t-shirt and a pair of sweatpants. He was wearing the watch Louisa had given him for Christmas. She'd come up to show it to us beforehand. It was kind of old-fashioned, with Roman numerals and a leather band, and I hadn't been sure Sal would like it, but it looked like he did. Mom was sleeping late. I wrote her a note. I went out. I'll get you a bagel. The laughing man wasn't on the corner. Maybe he didn't work holidays. Bell's was closed. Everything felt kind of peaceful and sad and deserted. My feet carried me to school, which was closed, of course. The yard gate was open, and I went in and sat on the jungle gym for a few minutes, letting myself feel how strange it was to be there alone. I was sort of deliberately trying to weird myself out, I think, to get my energy up, to call Anne Marie. 10 days of silence had grown into a question that my brain shouted inside my head.
Is Anne Marie even your friend anymore?
There was a payphone on the corner. I had a dime in my coat. As I dialed, I noticed someone leaning over the garbage can across the street. When he pulled himself upright, I saw it was the Laughing Man. He stood there with his hands on his hips, looking down at the garbage. I quickly turned my back to him, worried that he might recognize me and come over. The receiver of the payphone was cold against my ear. Only after it started ringing did it occur to me that if my mother was sleeping, Anne-Marie's parents might be sleeping too.
"Yellow!"
Anne-Marie's dad answered the phone. He sounded as if he'd been up for hours, just sitting by the phone and hoping it would ring.
"Hi, it's Miranda."
"Hi, Miranda. Happy New Year."
"Hi. I mean, Happy New Year to you, too. I was wondering if Anne-Marie is there."
"She is, but she's in the shower. Are you by any chance outside, Miranda? It sounds like you might be at a payphone."
"Oh, yeah, I am, actually."
"In the neighborhood?"
Yeah, I'm right by school."
"Well, come on over. I'm pouring you some orange juice right now."
Okay.
"You can surprise Anne-Marie."
"Would I ever?" I walked up the hill where the sunlight seemed to touch everything like it was a hyper kid running all over a toy store. It bounced off the dirty metal lampposts, the shiny brass awning posts, even the sunglasses of a woman walking her dogs with a cup of coffee in one hand. Everything shined.
"Miss Miranda, Happy New Year!"
Anne-Marie's doorman was standing just outside the building's polished doors. He smiled and waved me in. On the way up, it hit me that it was truly strange to come over here without talking to Anne-Marie first. But at the exact same time, I got nervous about that. I also got this other feeling, which I can only describe as love for Anne-Marie's elevator. The wood paneling, the cloth-covered stool in one corner, the little bell that went off every time we passed another floor. It was all so nice and cozy that I thought it would be wonderful to stay inside it forever, or at least to sit down on the little stool and close my eyes for a while. The whole thing was beyond weird. And then the elevator stopped on Anne-Marie's floor, and of course I got out, because that's what people do when the elevator gets to their floor. Anne-Marie answered the door in her robe with wet hair.
"Hi," I started. "I just called to say Happy New Year, and your dad said..."
She smiled.
"Come on in."
It was the best morning. Anne-Marie showed me her Christmas presents. She got all kinds of cool art stuff, and we ended up spreading it all over the dining room table and drawing comic strips on this special comic strip paper that came with stickers for the talking bubbles and the thinking bubbles. And then her mom showed us how to make origami frogs. And I was actually good at it. Meanwhile, her dad kept bringing in these plates of bacon and, for me, French toast strips I could pick up with my hands. Then Mom called. I had completely forgotten about her. She was frantic, she was angry, and she was coming to get me. Even Anne-Marie's dad looked mad.
"Better get your coat on," he said when I hung up the phone,
even though my mom couldn't possibly get to Anne-Marie's apartment that fast. So I waited by the door, overheating in my coat, and Anne-Marie waited with me.
"So, about what happened at Jimmy's," I said. "You know, I really never meant what he thought I meant, not for one second."
She looked at the floor.
"I totally believe you. And I don't know why I said that thing I said about money. It was stupid."
"It's okay." I was so grateful that she had something to apologize for that it didn't really occur to me to think about how it had actually made me feel. But I have thought about it since then. It didn't make me feel good. We heard the elevator's ding, and I opened Anne-Marie's front door before Mom had a chance to ring the bell. I thought I might be able to escape without Anne-Marie's parents talking to her. No such luck.
"Jerry?" Mom called out, and Anne-Marie's dad came rushing over, saying, "Oh, you're here. I didn't hear the bell.
I'm so sorry about this, Mom said.
No, I'm sorry. I had no